The Word of Mouth podcast is brought to you by
Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community.
With convenient locations throughout northern New England,
world-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more.
Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
Word of Mouth.
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 Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Well, it's February in New Hampshire, all presidential politics all the time. And soon enough, it will be President's Day, a day to celebrate the lives of the nation's leaders. We can also get really good deals on new and used cars, mattresses, and ski packages. Well, it is the death stories that our colleague Brady Carlson is more interested in, the ways that we choose to remember our presidents, from grand monuments to street corner statues to namesake sandwiches. In a new book called Dead Presidents, Brady is an exuberant guide to presidential wishes and myths and monuments, both official and forgotten, and what dead presidents reveal about ourselves, our history, and how we imagine our past and future. Brady Carlson is a reporter and weekend host here at NHPR and author of the new book, Dead Presidents. Brady, so glad you could find the place.
Well, thanks for such detailed directions.
Well, there's so many conventions now, you know, that are expected when a president dies. Of course, it wasn't always that way. George Washington, he wanted a private interment, no parade, no oration. Why were his wishes ignored?
That's one of the big questions in this world of the what I call the post-presidency. George Washington even put it in his will, I don't want a funeral parade, I don't want speeches, I don't want people lining out in the cold to honor me. I just want to be left alone. And the country just couldn't deal with that. At that point, the United States weren't really that united. The regions were going in different directions in a lot of different ways. And so there was a lot of question of how long the states would stay together as one nation. The idea that George Washington was holding it all together through the force of his personality and his personal magnetism as a heroic figure from the Revolution. And the idea of losing that figure, one of the most famous people in the world, was just too much. And so in a way, not to psychoanalyze the people of the late 1700s, but they thought if we keep him here in a sort of phantom form, if we turn him into this civic deity of sorts, this personal example that we can all follow, then we don't really lose him. We hang on to him, and then we can base our unity not on the living George Washington, but on the memory and the legacy of George Washington.
And at first, there was a statue of George Washington in a Grecian toga. Didn't go over all that well. And there were plans for a much grander obelisk than now stands as Washington Monument today. So what happened to that?
Well, the original idea came up before Washington had even died. There were people who wanted to celebrate his contributions to the American Revolution by building an enormous statue of George Washington with horses and all sorts of ornamentation, and they wanted it to be as big as possible. And of course, to make it as big as possible, that meant it had to be as expensive as possible. So they were trying to raise huge amounts of money. What wound up happening was they were having trouble bringing in these large marble bricks through the swampy area around where the monument sits today. In the 1840s or 1850s, they just simply ran out of money and they just stopped building right where they were, which meant there was this stump of a monument right in the middle of Washington, D.C.
Well, not a very distinguished sounding monument, but until it was. But distinction is a big part of these stories. You know, some of them grand deaths, some not so grand, and some, as you make the point, well-timed and not well-timed. So what's an example of a poorly timed death?
Well, probably the most poorly timed death would be our ninth president, William Henry Harrison, who took office on March 4th of 1841, gave a two-hour inaugural address in the cold and snow, and was not wearing a hat or coat at the time. Long story. But he wound up dying a month later, and the conventional wisdom was that he managed to catch a cold during that speech, which turned into pneumonia, which then killed him a month into his presidency. Now, whether that's actually true or not, we don't know, because there's some new research that's been done that suggests the water supply in Washington, D.C. was so bad and the sewer system at the time was so bad that that may have actually killed off President Harrison.
So he didn't die of his inaugural speech?
He may not have, but he was a well-known political figure, a very popular person at the time. And yet today, all he's remembered for is He was president for 30 days.
Well, he could have used a good doctor. So apparently could have James Garfield. Also did not have such a good run as president. But you found that he probably would have survived his assassination attempt if he'd had a better doctor. So who treated him and how?
Well, the lead doctor in his case was named Dr. Willard Bliss. And Doctor was his actual first name. He was named for the Dr. Willard, who helped his mother when he was being born.
Well, that's a way to skip through medical school.
It's always a good thing to have on your application, I think. The only problem was is that Dr. Bliss did not believe in the germ theory, which was just at that point starting to take hold less in the United States and more in the United Kingdom. And what killed James A. Garfield was not the bullet holes caused by his assassin, but the infections caused by the doctors who were poking their unsterilized hands, ungloved hands, inside the bullet wounds.
This was, of course, like the age of heroic medicine, but also of the Victorian era, this obsession with death. So how did that play out in how Garfield was mourned?
Garfield was shot just a couple of days before Independence Day, and they canceled Independence Day, essentially. There were no parades, there were no fireworks, there were no public displays of celebrating the founding of the nation. Everybody was freaking out. And then when he died, they built him an enormous castle. He actually has a death castle. It is at, you know, something like 100 feet high. And on the outside, there are these reliefs of his life and his death. So there's a relief on the outside of his tomb that shows him laying on his sickbed, starving to death, and being treated horribly for these infections by incompetent doctors.
All right, so this castle is built for him, right? And we have all of these traditions that date back to the Greeks and the Romans. And in the case of the riderless horse, I find out from your book, Genghis Khan. We have the caisson, the catafalque, you know, these European traditions, these august kind of symbols of mourning. And, you know, this is an interesting time because America is trying to distinguish itself from Europe, trying to distinguish itself from the lineage of kings. So what's going on here?
That's an interesting question. There's this dichotomy going on where Americans wanted to, and largely did in many ways, leave their presidents as citizens who happened to be president for a time and then returned to private life after their terms were up. So in the early days of the presidency, there were private funerals, sometimes huge ones in the case of George Washington, but private funerals. They were not run by the government. And they were buried privately on their own ground or in private cemeteries in the places where they lived. That changed in the 1840s, actually, with William Henry Harrison's death. He was the first president to die in office. And the people who were in charge of his funeral, essentially his cabinet, realized that American prestige had to be a part of the equation when they were designing his funeral. They wanted to commemorate Harrison in that very American way, as a plain coat-wearing, log cabin-loving kind
of
guy.
Or not coat-wearing in some cases.
And yet they wanted to make sure that as the fallen head of state of a powerful country, that that was acknowledged too. And so they did incorporate things like the riderless horse. They did incorporate a long parade going up through the streets of Washington, D.C. They did have a service in part of the White House and things like that. But once all of that was done, they stuck his body in a vault in Congressional Cemetery in Washington, D.C. for 3 months while they waited for the ground in Ohio to thaw so that they could send him home.
Brady Carlson is with us. Perhaps you've heard of him. He's weekend host here at NHPR. He's also author of a new book called Dead Presidents, an American adventure into the strange deaths and surprising afterlives of our nation's leaders. Okay, so we've learned a lot about some of the presidents, some of the things that weren't so unsavory about them. I'm thinking John Kennedy, Thomas Jefferson, you know, their private conduct, their sexuality. Maybe it's made them more human, but it has certainly changed their sense of legacy. So when does that become part of the thinking of the memorializing? You know, when do the docents at Monticello start talking about Sally Hemings and her descendants?
That's a difficult question, and usually it unfolds over time. Of course, the first rumors about Thomas Jefferson having a relationship with one of the people whom he'd enslaved started back when he was president. There had been rumors in a newspaper that were written off at the time as just anti-Jefferson campaign propaganda. And it would crop up every so often. It came up again during the Civil War or the lead up to the Civil War. And in the Civil Rights Movement, it would come back up again over and over. And it wasn't really until the last couple of decades when there was a DNA study done, and that confirmed that some male Jefferson was part of that line of individuals, that Sally Hemings did in fact have a relationship with some Jefferson. Now, this continues to be controversial among some Jefferson descendants, and there are all kinds of arguments as to which Jefferson it is. There's no way to conclusively say it was Thomas. But the long and the short of it is that the Jefferson family still controls the family burial plot. And if that were to be conclusively proved, then the Jefferson family would have to admit those descendants and allow them room in the burial plot. So far, the Jefferson family has not voted to do that. And so it remains controversial. And it shows you how someone who died in 1826 is still very relevant today, not just because of his presidency, but because of the issue of race and how it continues to resonate and continues to play out in America all these years and decades and centuries later.
Well, how someone is remembered and the legacy they shape for themselves is such an important part, of course, when you're looking about at presidents. I was so struck when you were writing about the funeral of Richard Nixon, who was showered with praise at his funeral in 1994, 20 years after he left the White House in disgrace. I mean, he was being praised from President Clinton, George McGovern, George McGovern, who I think compared him to Hitler at one point. So what is the symbolism there? I mean, is this just that we carry on no matter what?
I think in a lot of ways, people didn't feel like speaking ill of the dead. But I think also at the same time, Richard Nixon himself had worked for those 20 years after he resigned from the presidency to try to bring about a moment so that once he died, people would think differently about his life and his career and his legacy. He wound up working his way back so that he could counsel sitting presidents, and he would write books and he would give speeches. And people were clearly receptive to that, because the reception he got, I think, would have even surprised him. He was spoken of in these glowing terms. And in a way, they were able to find room in the narrative for those failings and for the resignation and the scandals. People in the eulogies talked about how, he would be knocked down, but he would never be knocked out. And he would make mistakes, but we should judge his whole record. And in a lot of ways, that is where we go when a president dies. We have this longing, it seems like, to turn these figures, flawed as they may be, into something that speaks to our better angels. We want to hold our presidents up to the height that we hold for the presidency itself.
Yeah. I'm talking about Dead Presidents with Brady Carlson. He's NHPR's weekend host and author of a new book called Dead Presidents. Now we've seen this big shift from the imposing memorials to the presidential library. So what does that shift mean in presidential regard, both by the public and by the self?
Well, the presidential library system is the big shift in how we remember presidents. And that started when Franklin Roosevelt was president. He wanted an archive to hold all of his papers, his public documents, and all of his personal memorabilia. He was a collector of things, and he had a lot of stuff, and he wanted a place to put all of this stuff so that historians could go through it and so that the public could go through it, and partly so that people could remember his presidency in a positive way. And that has become the somewhat controversial but guiding principles of the presidential library system, is that the presidents have a lot of say in how they're at least initially put together and the kind of messages they put out there about those presidencies. They are making a pitch for how they should be remembered. And the federal government, through the National Archives and Records Administration, is paying for that. Just in the way that presidents get state funerals, we're paying for all of the grandeur and the missing man airplane formations as they are laid to rest, and the military bugler playing taps. That's all paid for as part of a state funeral. And the presidential libraries are in part paid for by us as well. So it's worth taking a look at what they are and what they mean.
But are they any less grandiose than, a face on Mount Rushmore? I mean,
I never would have thought so until I realized how much square footage. I mean, they were talking about buildings that are hundreds of thousands of square feet. There are lots and lots of exhibits and lots of things like gifts that they've been giving by other heads of state, and and photo montages of what their lives and their careers were like. So in their own ways, they are just as big as putting something like the Lincoln Memorial or the Washington Monument together.
Grover Nordquist makes a big case. His crusade is something that you feature in your book. He wants to get Ronald Reagan Memorial in every single county in the United States. I think it's 3,000. You counted up something like that. But he does make the point that FDR, JFK, and he even mentions, I think, Martin Luther King Jr. These are all liberal Democrats who got memorials, big spenders in his mind, but not Ronald Reagan. Do you think that's a fair argument?
Well, I mean, it's certainly a big question. And I think a lot of the critics who will point to Grover Nordquist and the Reagan Legacy Project, as it's called, as an example of, you know, partisanship gone too far, will maybe forget that these things are sometimes built for partisan purposes. I mean, it was during the New Deal that Roosevelt had the Jefferson Memorial built in Washington, D.C. And that was in part because he was trying to tie his policies, which some people found very new and controversial at the time, to the legacy of Thomas Jefferson. It's a stretch in a lot of ways, but the idea of looking out for the little guy, Jefferson did it and I'll do it too. And he put Jefferson on the nickel at that same time. So it's not a necessarily new thing for people of a particular partisan persuasion to use a legacy like Jefferson's or Reagan's as a way to push a particular partisan vehicle. You could make the argument that conservatives who are about restraining the size of government may have a harder time doing this because of that philosophical viewpoint. I mean, the great example of that is Calvin Coolidge, who had people who wanted to build large monuments in his honor and have a big monument at his gravesite, and he turned them down. He said, that's kind of not who I am. I'm a believer that government should be smaller, not larger. And so in that way, yes, it is different, I think, a bit for conservatives than it might be for progressives.
Well, obviously, a lot has changed over the years. But how about for you? What did writing this book reveal to you about how we, the American people, view our dead presidents? You know, was there a sort of takeaway?
Well, that's a question that goes back really to the days of George Washington. Who is the president? Is it a person who belongs to the nation and is a mythical, historical, larger-than-life figure? Or is it as a human being who happens to have a very important job? And the country has wrestled with this in a lot of different ways. In the early days, as we saw with George Washington, that idea that the country needs a great man to bind it together, we see more of that style of memorializing. We see this enormous monument in the center of a city named for George Washington. It was the largest structure in the world at the time, bigger than any of the cathedrals in Europe. And you see the faces of Washington and Lincoln and Jefferson and Teddy Roosevelt on Mount Rushmore. You see that idea that we need to have big people because we're a big nation and an important nation, and important nations must have important figures guiding them through history. That's something that over time starts to recede somewhat for a lot of different reasons. One is that mass media means that the presidents are there in front of us every day. They're not remote, distant figures who are shaping things from afar. They're a little easier to engage with, and they're also more flawed. The more we have learned about presidents over time is that they're humans. They have good and bad points like everybody else, and some of them do some really not so great things. And it's hard to put a face on a mountain that's 12 times life size when you know what that person is capable of, good or bad. One of my favorite places that I visited in this whole crazy trip was near Mount Rushmore. It was just down the road in Rapid City, South Dakota. They have life-size statues of all the presidents on the street corners in downtown Rapid City. And I thought, what a great contrast. Here we have the two views of the presidents and the presidency, the huge, mythical, larger-than-life figures on Mount Rushmore, and the regular old life-size ones just standing right next to us as we walk down the street. And there's really room in America for both, I find. You know, it's nice to be able to look up at a figure and use them as an example or as an argument settler or someone you could name a school after. And then it's nice to also know that they're human beings like the rest of us. And maybe if they can reach these great historical heights, then maybe there's something great in it for us, too.
Dead Presidents on a Human Scale from Brady Carlson. Thank you so much.
It was a pleasure. Thank you.
Brady Carlson, he's an NHPR reporter and weekend host and author of the book Dead Presidents, an American adventure into the strange deaths and surprising afterlives of our nation's leaders. Now, Brady's going to be reading at several New Hampshire bookstores and bookstores in Cambridge, Massachusetts, New York City, and Washington, D.C., among other places. There's a full list of the events at wordofmouthradio.org.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Does your morning coffee taste better from your favorite mug, or does a bowl of pasta seem more appealing when served on a decorative plate? Science journalist Quentin Cooper met with some of the growing band of scientists who say that the food we eat is just a small part of our dining experience. Plate size and color and what the cutlery is made of, even background sounds, can affect how we enjoy it.
Go out for a meal and afterwards you might talk about the quality and range of menu, the service, maybe even the ambience. But what about the crockery or cutlery? It may come on a plate or a slate. You may eat with a silver spoon or a plastic spork. But in the end, all that matters is the food itself. Or is it? A growing band of scientifically savvy gastronauts think that even though we're barely aware of it, what we eat off and with can have a significant impact on what we taste. One such is Mark Miodovnik, Professor of Materials at University College London. Mark runs the Institute of Making, where scientists and artists and curious people can go see, touch and otherwise experience materials from all over the world.
So I've been collecting materials for a long time, and people have come to see my collection, often artists or architects. And this one artist came in, and unlike anyone else who'd ever looked at this collection, she started tasting the samples. And I was like, don't do that, loads of people pick them up. And she was like, why? Why do these metals taste different from each other? And I was like, I don't know. People don't really understand. We've been to the moon, you know, we've done all these amazing things, made mobile phones smart, but the mouth is an undiscovered, unexplored area.
So Mark started to experiment. He took seven identical teaspoons, had them electroplated in different metals and alloys, and then asked people to taste them.
We found that blindfold, people can tell the difference between gold, silver, zinc, copper, lots of different metals, even though they'd never in their lives had one of them in their mouths knowingly before. We had this hypothesis that that was to do with the reactivity of those metals, the so-called electrode potential. And we did all the experiments and then we plotted the data. And we found it was a straight line. We found that something as reactive as zinc or copper was thought of as metallic and bitter and highly unpleasant. And the stuff that was inert, we knew was highly unreactive in the mouth, like gold and chrome, was thought to be almost sweet and certainly pleasant.
Right. The more reactive, the more bitter, the less reactive, the more neutral, and therefore perceptually, the more sweet.
Yes. Basically, the mouth is a very, very sensitive instrument and can detect the reactivity of metals.
I wanted to try this for myself, so I took Mark's spoons, thank you, Mark, and found some unsuspecting students.
That one tastes really, really metally, like feels like it's reacting with my some of the fillings I have.
That's nice. Yeah.
Oh, it tastes nasty. It tastes like steel, maybe. It tastes like really like steel.
Sometimes some spoons I have at home taste like this, and I can't use them.
Very milky and tangy. I don't know, it's got like a tangy aftertaste. I don't know what it is. I can't really think.
One of the early stages in this was you hosted a dinner.
So this was when we were going down the road of trying to work out whether the spoons tasting different from each other could be used for a culinary expression for chefs to excite people, to make dining even more interesting or exciting or delicious. And so we worked with a Michelin star chef and found some really interesting things, like this curried prawn dish did actually taste better. Now, this is when I say taste better, what I mean is to us, you know, now it's now we're back into this realm of individual experience. But to us, the prawn curry tastes much better with a zinc spoon. And it somehow dialed down the chili. in our mouths. Now, we would love to go and do a controlled study on that, and that would be the next step.
As well as materials, there's a mental side to this too. Whether the cutlery's solid silver or partly plastic, you're also eating with your mind and eyes. So can changing how food is perceived affect how it's received and what we end up tasting? You bet it can. Charles Spence is Professor of Experimental Psychology at Oxford University. He's been studying interactions between all our senses, but increasingly looking at taste. So, Charles, why does this fall into the remit of psychology? What has psychology got to do with taste?
Absolutely everything. So, in a way, counterintuitively, I think the tongue is the least interesting bit of flavour experiences. Flavours are really constructed in the mind, as our brain combines our expectations delivered from what we see, from what we hear, from the smell of food, together with the taste in mouth, the retronasal odours that come as every time we swallow, and the sound of the crunch, the crackle, the creamy. So the flavours are really constructed in our brains from all of the sensory cues.
Back with our intrepid taste testers, it's time to get psychological.
Brilliant, just a quick, one more quick thing here, very quickly. Mm. You see two identical bits of cheesecake on two plates, but the plates, one white circular ceramic, one black square slate. Which looks most appetising to you?
The circle plate, I think. But the slate looks a bit more posh.
It's, I think a lot depends on the mood. And for example, if you've got a big bright plate, you can expect with bright flavours, you know.
Instantly, does one of them look more interesting than the other?
Yeah, because we're not used to seeing the cheesecake on a black slate, so that one looks more interesting to me.
Ah!
No, white plates is the one I normally eat, because you can see everything. Otherwise, if it's a different colour, I'm like, what is that? What is that? I think the white plate is what I prefer more.
Charles, we tried showing some students two identical-ish bits of cheesecake. We served one of them on a white round ceramic plate, one of them on a black slab, bit of slate. Very strong divisions, though, on this. So you've got individual tastes on top of everything else.
One question I might have was, in which direction was the slice of cheesecake pointing? Did you control it?
We didn't exactly control it, but what I can say is that the arrow of the slice of the cheesecake, that was pointing towards them, if that helps.
There you go, you see, people do not like that. From our research, we find that when food points towards you, be it a pizza slice, a slice of cheesecake, or even just a pickled onion, people do not like it as much as when exactly the same food is kind of oriented, pointing away from you. And the suggestion is that maybe our brain's fear circuits sort of fire up as soon as we see something pointing towards us, because that could be a weapon or something dangerous that might hurt us, and hence we had a little bit of a fear response.
You did a similar experiment. How did that work?
So this is an experiment, or a series of experiments now, that we've been running in different countries, in different restaurants and cookery schools, where we serve a dessert. It can be a cheesecake or a kind of a frozen strawberry dessert. And we serve it in the restaurant to half the people off a round white plate, to the other half of the diners exactly the same food off a black round plate, or better still, a black square angular plate. And we ask them, you know, how sweet is the dessert? How intense the flavour? How much do you enjoy it? And perhaps how much would you pay? And what we found across these various studies is that people will generally rate the dessert as tasting, on average, something like 10% sweeter when served on a round white plate than on a round black plate. If I make that black plate angular, you find even bigger effect again.
Let's say I was going to open a restaurant. Any advice you could give when I'm picking the cutlery or crockery?
I mean, there's a degree of personalisation, but over and above that individual element, there are some generalisations that hold. So, for example, we've just done work in a Scottish hotel, a restaurant, where we had 140 diners, and they're eating a Scottish fish main course, and half of the tables of diners had very heavy knife and fork. The other half of the diners were eating the same food in the same day in the same room, but with light canteen cutlery. Those with the heavy cutlery in their hands were willing to pay significantly more and thought more highly of the food. So that would be a generalisation, I bet, no matter what you're serving. Add a little weight in the hand and that will pay off.
What, though, do Mark Miodovnik and Charles Spence think is the next step in this exciting new science of taste? Have chefs already started to take up Mark's ideas? Are there already restaurants out there where if you order the prawns, you'll eat them with the zinc cutlery?
So we don't know of any restaurant yet that's kind of advertising that as an experience, but I would be very surprised if that doesn't crop up on a menu soon. I mean, cooking is science and it is art. And this is just another aspect of that science-art kind of interface, which is that here's a bit of science, we've investigated it. Now we hand it over to these people who are able to take a complex area and they're able to kind of translate it into a taste and to an experience in the restaurant.
I think the best, the fastest, the most beautiful innovation happens in those restaurants. And then you take things that work there and say, how can we spin them out to help improve the quality, say, of hospital food? How do we take these insights about the weight of the cutlery, the shape of the plate, for those with a silver palate, you know, over 70 years of age or so, who have lost the ability to smell to some degree and to taste? We can see in practice that some of these older individuals may be adding, you know, five or more times as much salt to a bowl of tomato soup to get the same taste impression as a younger person has. So huge health consequences there. And the question is, can we, through plateware, through cutlery, through music, through lighting, through some other means, deliver some of that lost sensation?
I'm Quentin Cooper, and the producer is Hannah Marshall.
And this production is part of the STEM Story Project, distributed by PRX and made possible with funding from the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation. A shoe can change your life. Just ask Cinderella. Or outside of the fairy tale realm, Marilyn Monroe, who is credited with saying, "Give a girl the right shoes and she can conquer the world." And the right shoe for her purposes had to be the high heel, an instrument of torture to some and empowerment to others. The teetering heel is a triumph of fashion over function. There are few elements of clothing that are more mocked or coveted or divisive. An extensive exhibition of centuries of historic and contemporary high heels, from the whimsical to the sublime, along with a series of short films, is about to step out in killer heels, the art of the high-heeled shoe. It's going to be on view at the Currier Museum of Art beginning on February 6th and running through May. And Samantha Cataldo, assistant curator at the Currier Museum of Art, is with us to tell us more. Samantha, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So, you know, reading about this show and thinking about how high heels, you know, they're desire, their division, their vanity, their frailty. Why are they so polarizing?
Well, I think you've sort of nailed it in just your intro to the question. Certainly today, obviously, the heel is very feminized. The heel is associated with women. It's a symbol of femininity in many ways, for better or worse. But what's interesting about this exhibition is it sort of traces the heel's history, and it wasn't always worn by women. It wasn't always just a symbol of femininity. It had very practical means. And as it evolved and became what it is today, I think that's when it became more loaded. And when any article of clothing becomes associated with greater meaning beyond just covering the body, providing warmth and protection, I think it starts to take on a greater conversation.
Well, and as you said, you know, long before there was Sex in the City or the shoe right. cam, there were high heels worn by aristocratic men.
Right.
Now, when was this?
And so that, we're thinking Louis XIV, Louis mm-hmm. XV, Louis XVI, especially if you're looking at portrait paintings of that time. People might recall, you know, in all their regalia, these large kind of brocaded capes, and then they always had their dainty white stockinged legs sticking out from beneath with these high-heeled shoes. And one of the kind of types of shoes that came out of that period and is still around today, it was called the Louis heel.
The Louis heel?
Yes, and named after Louis XV. And you see the Louis heel in this exhibition. So an early example from the early 1700s up to a modern reinterpretation by Manolo Blahnik from just the last few years.
So with Louis XIV, it was clear that this was about prestige. This was about impracticality.
Exactly. Power. Power and status. And like anything else, if you can wear frilly, impractical clothing, you're obviously a person of means. So the heel started in many cases as something that was practical. In the case of the high heel as we know it, most scholars believe that it originated with cavalrymen, Persian men on horses in the army, and the heel would provide stability in their stirrups. So it came from a very functional place. And the aristocratic men of Europe who came in contact with these cavalrymen adopted it as a masculine power symbol. And then by about the 1700s, they started becoming, you know, extra high, extra dainty, and then too impractical, and then were kind of given over to women who readily adopted them.
Well, one of the things you mentioned, you know, the Louis heel coming back around, it strikes me in looking at these that there are some very basic designs that just keep coming back around and around.
Right. And that's one of the things that you'll see in the exhibition. The exhibition was organized by the Brooklyn Museum by their curator of exhibitions, Lisa Small. And she set out to organize it not chronologically, but more in themes, which makes it for a really interesting and rich show. Because you can see the chronology within the themes, but you also get these different insights into the shoe. And one of the first themes, fittingly, is revival and reinterpretation, which is all about what you're, you know, talking about. What's old is new again, and everything's sort of cyclical. And people are constantly reinterpreting it, reinventing it. Things are coming back, thinking of, you know, the platform heel, originally more in the 30s, and then the 70s, I think, is what most people associate it with. The platforms, thinking of glam rockers, David Bowie, even men wearing heels in that time, came back in the 90s in full force and haven't really left, been, you know, in and out of fashion. So even just in the 20th century, a shoe that's gone through a couple cycles.
So keep your Persian riding boots around long enough and they'll come back around.
Yeah.
Well, and there, of course, is a lot of associations with the pain of the high heel. And there's another category that actually looks very much on the sort of history of the Asian, the Eastern heel. Tell us a little bit more about that. Do you actually have shoes that would fit bound feet?
We do. And actually, interestingly, and this goes back to the idea that we've organized it in categories, we have one pair of shoes for bound feet, and those are actually in the metamorphosis category. So thinking of a physical metamorphosis involved in being able to wear these shoes, which were strikingly tiny when we were installing them. I think we were all surprised when we all saw them. But in terms of this other section is kind of devoted to the East, called Rising in the East. So the idea of these elevated shoes coming out of the East and how those forms have influenced Western forms of high heels throughout the last centuries. Things that we're looking at there are the Japanese geta, which is a risen wooden sandal. And that, again, came from very practical means, first worn by farmers who needed to be above the kind of muddy rice paddies, was used by priests or in religious ceremonies, and then got higher and more hard to walk in and more impractical, and then were used by geishas mainly, who needed to perform when they were walking in them in this very slow, halting gait, which is considered in that time, in that society, to be very attractive.
Yeah, I'm just looking at these images of them. They're fantastic. You know, these teeny tiny bottoms that just rise up like a sort of fluted vase or something like that. But the shoes themselves are beautiful. And you can see in this other Rising in the East, these more contemporary shoes, these kind of architectural, just fantastic shoes. So this gives you the idea of, you know, this isn't an art museum. These are works of art.
I completely agree. And I think that throughout culture, there's always objects that are meant to be functional, but how we adorn them, I think, is what defines the culture that you're in, how much adornment you're putting on them. I think a lot of people, when they go through art museums and seeing a more utilitarian object like a chest on chest or something like that, and seeing how much effort people put into decorating this object that's mainly functional, is always sort of interesting. So the shoe itself, as a supposedly functional object, many of them in the show people will see, hard to stand in and walk in or get your foot in. And that is one of the aspects of the show, is that some of the shoes are much more art, sculpture, conceptual art than a shoe you would buy at a store and wear to your next cocktail party.
Right, right. Some of them, you know, you look at them and you just think pain. There's a kind of revulsion that goes with it.
Right. And that's explored throughout the show, and especially there's this section going back to that theme of glamour and fetish. Mm-hmm. Glamour, that obvious thinking, you know, the sparkly, frilly shoes that are all about beauty. And then fetish is obviously that other side of heels where they're often thought of as erotic and symbols of eroticism. There's also that element of danger. When you're looking at some of these sharp dagger-like heels, and the stiletto itself, those very thin, sharp-like heels, is named the Italian word stilettos, a long, thin dagger. And so some of the shoes definitely play off that danger lurking with that kind of femme fatale, I think, is how you look at those shoes.
My guest is Samantha Cataldo. She's assistant curator at the Currier Museum of Art, and we're talking about a new exhibition that's opening there this weekend. It's called Killer Heels, The Art of the High-Heeled Shoe, and it tracks the long history of high-heeled shoes from the historic to the fabulous and contemporary. I'm also thinking of this sort of economic divide, you know, back to the Louis XIV, mm-hmm. right? That now we have the shoe cams. You know, anybody can watch these the red carpets. And there's this idea that, oh, we could have those shoes, mm-hmm. then we would be transformed. And mm-hmm. I think a lot of people, especially in New Hampshire, I know a lot of people, and I'm going to say women primarily, you know, we're in this place of determined practicality where mm-hmm. we have to wear slushy boots half the time of the year. But we have these little secret vehicles of transformation, you know, sitting in our closet. Is that part of it? You know, that it's accessible. We can transform with a pair of shoes.
I think so. And one of the things that you mentioned briefly was that Cinderella. Mm-hmm. I think most young girls now, especially in America, you watch Cinderella when you're younger, you know that story. And at the heart of it, a woman is transformed by a shoe. And our show actually has two pairs of glass slippers in it. So that illusion is made pretty clear. But it is that idea that the shoe transforms a woman if she is so inclined to be transformed. Obviously, there are many women who want nothing to do with high heels. They don't want to have to wear them. They're good in their sneakers. They're good in their flats. But a lot of women feel empowered when they wear them. They feel taller. They feel stronger. Maybe it completes an outfit. It makes you, again, look leaner, your body posture changes. And so it physically and psychologically can have a transformative effect. So this very simple idea of just putting on different shoes.
Are there any that you've been coveting in particular?
I mean, some of the shoes that I love the most in the exhibition are things that are foreign to me in many ways. They're way before my time. They're from a different culture. So there's this lovely pair. This was one of my favorites, certainly, but even before I saw them, of elevated Syrian sandals from the 19th century. And they're essentially kind of two planks of wood, you know, vertical on top of a sandal. And they're about a foot tall, but they're beautiful. They're sort of beaded and they have mother of pearl inlay. And the purpose of them, where they came out of, were the Ottoman Empire bathhouses. So women would wear them to keep their feet above the water and keep their feet dry.
Well, Samantha, we know this is a place for comfortable, practical shoes for the most part in New Hampshire. So are you thinking this exhibit is maybe a little bit of a fantasy, a place where we can let the bridle off a little bit and think about what kind of shoes we could wear?
Maybe, yeah. I think certainly there are people who go through this exhibition and they're just going to see beautiful shoes that they wish they could own, that they have in their closet or that they might want to wear. But the other thing that's interesting is that these objects tell stories. They're very much cultural objects that talk about where they came from, who made them, what was going on in society at the time they were made. And so they really have a lot more to say than just these beautiful objects. So I think other people will appreciate it as sort of a history through shoes. I think it can be many things to many people, and it's all what you want to get out of it. I hope people will be pleasantly surprised by all that they find inside the exhibition.
Samantha Cataldo, thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
Samantha is assistant curator at the Currier Museum of Art, and Killer Heels, The Art of the High-Heeled Shoe, is on view at the Currier Museum beginning on February 6th and running through May. All the information online, including a link to that for the Killer Heels party at wordofmouthradio.org. Open toe. You be looking good when you rock them so. Put your heels on, girl. Them heels on, lady. Hit your grind hard. You drive me crazy. Planning on changing the world just like me. You could be the chairwoman and I'll be the trustee. Let me give all. Thanks so much for your listening time today. There's much more to hear and explore at wordofmouthradio.org. And you can listen to the show anytime with the Word of Mouth podcast. You'll find it by searching Word of Mouth and HPR in iTunes. And if you like it, please rate it on iTunes. It'll help others find it when shared by Word of Mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott, back tomorrow at 2 on NHPR.
Word of Mouth is produced by Taylor Quimby,
Logan Shannon,
Molly Donahue,
Megan Tan, and senior producer Maureen McMurray.
Our volunteer is Pam Maroney. The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR,
its Board of Trustees,
or its underwriters.
Word of Mouth is a production of New Hampshire
Public Radio. How your heels set it all.